Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, Heritage Radio Network has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Support comes from the Pennsylvania Hemp Summit, November 14th and 15th, convening hemp industry stakeholders to learn, connect, and grow. Details at pahempsummit.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Sam Kotori. We'll talk to Sam about Winery 16600, talk about his dad Phil a little, podcasting, there's something going on there, and more. We'll taste one of Sam's Syrahs for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Sam Kotori is a fourth-generation wine guy hailing from Sonoma royalty dating back to the 60s. His dad, Phil, started a farming company in the late 70s, practicing thoughtful and organic farming from the get-go, and continues to be one of the most sought-after vineyard minds in wine. Sam worked in public relations, political campaigns, and cannabis before joining Winery 16600, the family winery, as proprietor in 2011. The winery focuses on single vineyard wines and Rhone varietals in the Moon Mountain District in Sonoma. 16600 is the closest thing to wine as the Grateful Dead is to music. Sam Kotori, as I mentioned, is also a fellow podcaster. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Sam.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Sam.
All right, so we're talking to Sam in New York City at his imported distributor, Field Blend Selections. Thank you to Jake for that. All right, so let's get right into it. So you grew up around a pretty colorful and, I would say, you know, influential wine family. I want you to tell me a little about your journey, and I mentioned, you know, PR and campaigns and cannabis and all that. I also mentioned your dad. I want you to tell me about your journey in life and wine that really got you to the table here talking about 16600. So where do we start?
You know, we actually had a podcast guest on our show we do out of Sonoma a few weeks ago. Musician named G Love, and
One of my favorites.
Yeah. It was a well received show, and we were talking about my family history just a little bit, and he had the greatest thing. He said that my life has been drenched in wine, and you know, I hadn't really. It seems sort of self evident now, but growing up in Sonoma in the 80s and 90s, it was. Maybe I just didn't realize. I don't know if it was such a thing that it has become. So, you know, there was wine everywhere.
During the time.
Right. I was in the vineyards my whole life, you know, making wine at my uncle's, Kotori Winery. But it was not, I mean, as you said in my bio, it was not like the direction in life that I ever thought I would be going. And what I came to find out when I came back to the family, you know, to the business, that this is actually what I had been doing the whole time. You know, I was, you know, junior.
Was that always You didn't realize it, or you always knew you'd come back, or nothing was clear, right?
No, you know, I...
Because you even left the state to go to college.
Right, I went to Nevada for
you
college.
You didn't do the Davis thing or any of the other...
No.
You went to Nevada.
I was definitely not a good enough student to go to Davis.
Okay.
You know, maybe I could have...
I would have thought somebody had a little pull, but I guess...
No.
Not that much pull.
Not that much pull. You can't pull those grades that hard. I went to Nevada. I was a ski bum. I was, you know, going to be a journalist. I realized quickly that it wasn't going to be journalism. It was going to be the PR side and politics, and worked on some, you know, statewide campaigns.
Why was that? Did you see journalism more as writing, or a little more thought and effort, where PR is more razzle-dazzle?
I think I had a better time making the news than telling the news.
Okay.
I was, you know, the creating side of it, as opposed to the sort of retelling side of it, and you know, I was a poli sci guy, so I saw that connection there. Started working. I worked for Jimmy Carter's son for a campaign. He ran for Senate in Nevada. I got to hang out with the Carters.
So you stayed in Nevada.
I stayed in Nevada. Okay. I worked for and then. After the campaigns, I worked for a national PR agency, but started in Nevada, the way the What Happens Here Stays Here, Las right. Vegas ad guys. And I worked, you know, I was the bottom of the totem pole in Carson City, you know, hustling for these guys. But I'd go to dinner, you know, with legislators and CEOs and, you know, king-making lobbyists, and they'd hand me the wine list. And I didn't really like it. Just I was like, oh yeah, I know wine. I can order the wine.
Did they hand it because they knew a little about the background, or
I mean, you know, I must have said something at some point, but
maybe somebody Googled it.
Somebody, and they would, you know, I would be the guy ordering the wine. So it was sort of when I got back that I realized, like, I was always a wine guy,
right?
Whether or not that was really like what I thought I was pursuing in life.
So how long were you doing the PR and campaign stuff?
It felt like forever, but it was really 2005 to 2009.
Okay, so I mean, you got
4 years, 5 years.
More than dipping your toe.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know if chronologically one runs into the other, but the cannabis thing is intriguing to me
because
I do a lot of research, but I didn't really dig into what you were doing. But the way I look at it is you were kind of around it fairly early on. I mean, it's more than a thing now. Then it was...
Yeah.
So tell me what you were doing.
Well, that was the other product that I grew up around. So
it was
very natural in my life.
Yeah.
But after I got laid off from the agency and, you know, the 08-09 recession... I found a job with some friends who had it was essentially a medical cannabis startup in Oakland, and we had this big grow facility. We were trying to get permitted, and I was the public affairs and PR guy. I would, you know, wrote big chunks of our application and would, you know, speak before
the
Oakland City Council.
So you, to this day, you know this business.
I
Now in those days, it was just medicinal.
It was just medicinal,
right?
2010 was when I started, and that was the first, it was Prop 19. It was the first time that California tried to legalize recreational adult use.
How long did it take? I forgot.
That failed.
Right, and not that long ago,
so
right?
That was 2010, and I think maybe in 12 or 16 was when, 16 was really when
I think it was 16.
Yeah, when
I
really like
12.
Yeah, it was 16, so that was, you know, another 6 years, and for sure... All of our investment dried up when Prop 19 failed in 2010, and that was essentially what, you know.
So that was close to walking into the winery.
Yeah,
2010, 2011, which is I think when you went. But tell me a couple things about the journey. So you alluded to it. I know it. You kind of grew up in a hippie wine family. I mean, your mom, portrayed by your dad, was like this Jersey hippie.
I'm sure that there's a bottle up here. Yeah, from the Rossi Ranch. My parents met picking grapes in 1977 because, you know, my mom had just left a commune and needed a job. You know, my dad grew up in San Francisco in the 60s. My grandparents thought that they could keep my dad and my uncle out of trouble by taking them out, you know, out of the city and up to the country in Sonoma and putting them to work in the vineyard. Failed miserably in the keeping them out of trouble part of the equation, but definitely kind of brought the family heritage into back to the vineyards.
So if you and I got out of a car and pulled up and your mom and dad were there, would I still sense that, you know, their sensibilities? Like, I'm not that much younger than them. You know, I'd say, whoa, I mean, these guys remind me of growing up. I mean, your mom still carry all that and everything? Is she an old hippie?
They're both old hippies, okay. For sure. Yeah, you know, I mean, my dad taught me how to shave, let's put it that way.
Okay.
bald beard with the ponytail kind of guy he is now.
Right. You
know. But let's put it this way. When I was working as essentially a lobbyist, my parents saw me in my blue suit and my red tie and my little like paid lobbyist badge.
Oh, man.
And they go, where did we fail? Like, how did we fail you? You know, every other parent would be like, oh, wow, this kid's got a job.
So good segue to this question. So because of that, what drew you to the industry? Was it just that what was going on in front of you in Nevada? I mean, it doesn't sound like you plotted that career.
No, you know, I think that in my time away from Sonoma, the industry grew, and it's really, you know, in a lot of ways, but in a lot of what it grew towards was the hospitality experience, the fancy building, the caviar and champagne, the winemaker, the barrel, and people stopped talking about the vineyard. And what brought me back was...
Which is really what your dad is all about.
Yeah, this was a way, you know, what I see 16600 as is our way of shifting that focus back to the part of it that really matters, which is where the grapes were grown, how it was grown, and who grew them. All the rest of it is great, but if you don't have that part, none of the rest of it matters.
I agree, and you know, one of the reasons I wanted to sit with you is, you know, you walk the walk, talk the talk. Been doing it before it was, you know, cool or hip or whatever. And in a good way, it's a big topic now. People are writing books on regenerative farming, and guys like Raj Parr are falling off the map and going into this regenerative farming, you know, thing, which is, you know, all nice and everything. Couple last things. What do you think of the cannabis industry now? I mean, does it seem like a missed opportunity? Are you happy it's where it's at? It's here, but it's not what it should be. Give me some thoughts.
My feelings about the cannabis industry are a lot of like my feelings about the wine industry.
Well, there's parallels too.
There's all these parallels, and you know, all the hype is about THC levels and you know, how many crops a year you got, and the things that I enjoy in that world are grown in real soil under the sun, and you know, you can have two strains from two different farms on the opposite side of the mountain, and let's talk about why they taste different, why they smell different.
You're more of a purist.
I'm definitely, you know, I know how to roll joints. I don't have a vape, you know, those things. But the cannabis industry definitely isn't at a place yet where we can talk about it in terms of terroir and farming. It's still like evolving out of this prohibition where nobody wanted to talk about where,
you
know,
you hit it. That's a great point. I mean, right? I get it. Because, you know, I do this and you do it and, you know, we're around it. I think a lot of people don't give a crap, but I think a lot do, because a lot of people have gone organic food, organic wine, natural wine, and they'll realize, you know, that that's important. Will it get there?
I believe it'll get there. I mean, I believe if we keep talking about it and supporting small farmers and caring about our food and our wine, that caring about where our cannabis comes from is a natural.
I agree. I mean,
you can only hope, right?
Right. Chances are the guy getting high is, you know, organic, and if they're drinking wine, they're drinking natural wine, and, you know, care about climate change and all that. So let's hope they're right about that.
But there's also still people who buy wine at, you know, the drugstore,
the supermarket,
and buy their cannabis because it's got a shiny package at the dispensary, and. That's okay.
Who knows better than you as a PR and a marketing guy? I mean, it's, you know, I think you've become grounded where you understand what goes into everything. I think a lot of it is just like when you make wine for $12, it looks the same, it tastes the same, doesn't matter about the vintage or, you know, whatever.
Right.
Which is kind of cool. All right, so let's move on a little. Okay. That's good background.
You got lots of questions there. So
that's good background. Yeah. All right, so one thing I couldn't figure out is 16600 came around, what was it, 2007-ish?
First legal vintage was 2007. You know, my dad had gotten bonded. It essentially sort of grew out of the separation of Enterprise Vineyard, which is my dad's company, and Katuri Winery, which is my uncle's winery. And, you know, my cousin was coming into it at that time. So, you know, my dad had grapes that had been going to Tony. He stopped sending them to Tony and had to make them somewhere. And then
so,
had too much and had to get legal.
So before 16600, there was Katuri.
Yeah.
There was your dad's successful business and all that. So that's sort of what he was doing. Why at that time did it make sense? Like, hey, let's get a name.
Yeah.
Let's put this under one roof. Was it kids? Like the way to get the kids together?
Yeah.
What about terms with your dad and Tony? Okay.
They're, you know, as good as Italian brothers and
okay.
family business can be.
Well, you heard stories of the Mondavis with fist fights. I mean, none of that stuff.
Well, right? You know, there was less to fight over than the Mondavis.
Okay. That's a good point.
You know, it's good. We Enterprise Vineyards harvested the Katuri estate for Tony last week.
Oh, okay.
You know,
so their family is still...
It's, you know, really what it was, Katuri Winery didn't necessarily have room for all of us, and so I do think, you know, in his masterfully Italian father manipulative way, that Phil started, you know, making 16600 with the idea of like, well, maybe this is a way that we can.
I like where it went.
Two's
better than one. The more the merrier.
And
with the right people,
right.
You know. So I mean, it's a good thing. Let's fawn over your dad a little because he deserves a little, you know, recognition. From your lens, tell me about his influence on California wine. I always wonder what compels a guy to like grow organically or thoughtfully when nobody was doing it. Is that the old, you know, hippie sensibility? I mean, tell me about influence and tell me why.
So, I mean, the Phil story and sort of the convergence of he got sent out to the vineyards at 13 to, you know, prune vines for a nickel a vine and you know, that kind of thing. Came up in Sonoma working for this legendary grape grower named Joe Miami, who, you know, definitely not organic, you know, better living through chemistry, 50s and 60s and the whole deal. But every harvest, you'd pick grapes in the morning and Joe would send you out to, like, spread oat seeds. Knowing that there's going to be a fall rain that'll help set that seed and keep your topsoil.
So it was like a cover crop.
Well, a cover crop before anybody called it.
And not everybody was doing that.
Right. And what Joe did, you know, Joe most famously farmed Monte Rosso, you know, mountain vineyard. And in the mountains, you have to keep all the soil you can. At the same time, somebody, the neighbor in Glen Ellen, gave my dad a crate full of organic gardening journal, you know, Rodale Institute. And he started a compost pile and was, you know, growing vegetables and cannabis and whatever.
He started a compost pile with the magazines?
No, from the magazines.
I know, I'm busting.
The magazines probably turned into a compost pile on their own. But he didn't, you know, put those two things together necessarily until the late 70s. And actually the wine that I opened is from the property that he first farmed organically, and
Dos Limones,
and
right.
You know, the landowner there. Let's
pour that. We'll talk about it more later.
Yeah,
but let's start sipping it. What are we doing here?
Family living on the property that didn't want their kids playing in a vineyard where Roundup was being sprayed. And you know, I say this in the tasting room. You know, I say it to people and get the same. You get head nod. 2022. Yeah, don't play in the Roundup. 1979.
The Roundup wasn't that huge then. I mean, it was relatively.
It was expensive. Employed. But it was used. It was used for weed control in the vineyards.
Right.
And So that sort of started the journey. The interesting thing about this vineyard site is it neighbors Bob Kennard's vegetable farm, and that was the first vegetables that Alice Waters, organic vegetables, Waters would source for Chardonnay. So it's a little sort of like nexus of the organic movement up on Sonoma Mountain. And you know, the joke that my dad always says is it took him 40 years to be an overnight success. But there was certainly something that I saw from the time that I left Sonoma and then came back. And I went to high school in Napa, and I would take the bus through Carneros, and it would be, you know, the ground floor of every vineyard was dirt, you know, sprayed, tilled, the whole thing. And when I came back 8-9 years later, they're still spraying Roundup, but they're growing a cover crop in between. And I was like, oh, well, that's new. And there was a paradigm shift, you know, in the 2000s that winemakers, both sides of, you know, the Mayacamas Mountains, Napa and Sonoma, realized that a better way to make better wine is to
farm. So there was some shift. Not everyone bought in.
Right.
They weren't, it sounds like they did cover crops maybe a little more. Why does it take like a Napa so long and parts of Sonoma? Is it just the people, the business? I mean, there's just not people walking around with the sensibility that your dad had.
I mean,
everyone should be doing it.
Right. It seems self-evident. But first of all, nothing moves quickly in the wine business.
No, obviously.
It's deeply rooted in the way it has been. And, you know, the other piece of it is, it's while, you know, it has this luxury good sort of top end, it's still an agricultural product with really small margins, and people aren't willing to take what they saw as risks. You know, if the chemical salesman said, this is how
Napa,
this is the way to get to...
exemplifies that as much or more than anywhere. Just because of land value,
right,
and cost of doing business. Yeah, I guess. I mean, are you hopeful that things will continue?
The thing that I find the most hope in, as a, in the wine business, is certainly more than ever people are talking about. Climate is obviously,
I wanted to get into that.
All those things.
Because nobody knows better than that than your dad.
Right.
And then now that you've been on the ground for a while, you're seeing it. So it's a good... So
right.
Go ahead.
But the point being, the wine business, because it's, this luxury good and has this sort of elevated perception globally, has the opportunity, and in many cases are taking it to lead in regenerative farming and, climate conscious decision making in the way that we do. And, 25 years ago, there was no organic food in Walmart. And now there's organic food in Walmart, right? And maybe
good
it's
point.
Not like the standards of, Bob Kennard and Alice Waters in the 70s.
Well,
that's
a whole other show,
But it got there. And biodynamic wasn't a thing people talked about until the wine business started adopting biodynamic farming practices and talking about it. And, now you go to Whole Foods and there's biodynamic macaroni and cheese.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So if we keep doing that with the stature that the wine business has, pushing these things forward, that's what gives me hope, for sure.
I think you're right. I think the current generation getting younger is more aware and more demanding of that. So I think that's going to naturally push it too. I think the old cult Cali Bordeaux guys, they don't think about it as much, and they're not being pushed out. They're just, there's attrition there, So, so climate change, as far as your vineyards and your estate vineyard, is it earlier picking? Is it? I mean, what is what's the obvious major impacts?
It's it's endemic in the way we think about everything. It's your pruning plan. It's your water use plan. Pick dates have shifted. You know, we
so everything has changed.
The envelope, but pick dates have shifted. One of the things it talked about, the Colt Bordeaux of Napa Valley. One of the things that we've done, there's shade cloths. There's these misting systems to lower ambient temperature. But the fruit zone has also risen 6 inches, 12 inches, depending on the...
What does that mean, the fruit zone has risen?
So when you train the grapevine, on the trellis system, you're trying to have all the fruit that you're... Especially when you're talking about, top-tier cabernets.
Right.
You want it to all basically be on the same level.
Right. You kind of train it to do that?
You can train it to do that.
So you're saying it's getting higher?
So you're moving in up a wire or two to get it away from the reflected heat from the ground.
So you have to pivot on that.
You're changing the way the vines look.
That's interesting.
To in reaction. And again, you can only do these things so much before you have to change a lot of other things. But
I forgot what you call it—the leaves, sort of trellis or
the canopy.
The canopy. I mean, some people believe in canopy, light, heavy. Some don't. Right. I mean, are you forced because of the heat?
You're definitely more aware of it. This was a challenging year in that we actually didn't have a super hot summer. So a lot of people were opening up
22
their
canopies. 22
vintage. 22 vintage.
Okay.
A lot of people were during our fairly cool, foggy summer, were opening up canopy, taking leaves off, and then Labor Day weekend happens and we're 110 degrees for five days straight, and everything got fried. But it is, down to row alignment and changing the way we're thinking about you don't line your rows up parallel to your road or your driveway or Silverado Trail or something. You are replanting vineyards 5 degrees off true north to make sure that there's just as much shade and sun on either side of the vine, really from the ground up.
That's crazy. I didn't realize that. Yeah, so that's going to continue to evolve.
And then varietals will continue to evolve.
Yeah, I want to talk to you that in a minute, because when we talk about the winery and the wine, I just want to tell everybody we're talking to Sam Kotori. Sam is the proprietor of 16600, a winery in the Moon Mountain AVA in Sonoma. All right, so let's talk about the winery. There's a lot to talk about. Like we said, the varietals, the vineyards, winemaking, philosophy, all that stuff. First, tell me, you alluded to it a little, how and why did 16600 come about? I mean, you kind of mentioned it was time to maybe stop putzing around with with Tony or whatever.
I mean, what it came from was my dad really wanting to show off the vineyards that he was farming in a more direct way. And it started with our estate Zinfandel, Moon Mountain District. The address there is 16600.
Right.
So if you want to look it up on Google or go say hi to my parents, you can find it.
Easy
to remember. The idea is make single vineyard wines that are about, being as specific to a place as an address, and really, taking the opportunity that we have to talk about the expression of place and talk about terroir. Things I love to do in the tasting room, and it's harder with in the market because you can't have as many wines out. But to put two different Zinfandels from two different vineyards that are the same vintage, same grower, same winemaker in front of somebody, and it doesn't matter if they have a master somm or it's the first time they've done wine tasting. You see those differences, you feel those differences,
right?
And you have this conversation about place that I thought was so missing in a lot of what the
so that's really the mission statement, to show off what he's been doing, to get a sense of place. I think you said in wine lies opportunity to express a sense of place.
Yeah.
Okay, so I know you're going to say yes, but is Sonoma the right place to make these wines? And why? And maybe now we can get into varietals. Was Rhone a passion, or it's better in that environment?
It's both.
Okay.
You know, I feel extraordinarily lucky to have grown up in Sonoma, which is one of the great places on the planet to grow things, period.
You know,
people come to Sonoma and they have the worst allergies that they've ever had in their life because everything blooms all year round. Everything grows there. And for sure, there are these little corridors and pockets of the world where grapes grow into fantastic wine. We're lucky to be in one of those places. You know, I always joke, you know, Cabernet put me through college, but the wines that we collect and drink as a family were almost always, you know, if they weren't from California, they were from the Rhone Valley. And you know,
so always a love and nod towards the Rhone.
Yeah, exactly.
And an influence.
Right.
So when you have Rhones on the list, that's why.
That's why, but it's also...
Also, the way they make wine, guys like Jean Gonon and all those guys are farmers.
They're farmers.
Thoughtful.
And the other piece of it is, you know, it was 120 degrees at Oakville Crossroad and Silverado Trail 2 weeks ago, and Cabernet isn't going to be able to last in that climate forever. And we watched these Cabernet vineyards shrivel and dry up in this heat wave, and the Grenache didn't look like it was, you know, sweating at all. And it's of the varieties that we're all exploring, and there's, you know, others on this list, that has a ability to withstand a changing and unpredictable climate. So there's definitely that piece of it too.
I think,
like, hey, this is something we can do really well. And
I think you're going to see a more than a slow roll on change, because you're not going to be able to survive. I mean, Napa may be the outlier because that's their wheelhouse, but if you can't grow it or continues to get hotter, you have fires. All right, so I think we can talk about the wines through the vineyards and all that. So tell me about the vineyard. So let's start with, the family has an estate vineyard,
yeah,
and that is where you grow Zinfandel.
Right.
So is that property where you guys live? Is that something that you've had forever? Is that the field you ran through as a kid type thing?
Pretty much. Well, it's the steep, rocky terraces that I ran through as a kid and fell down and lost all of our soccer balls and baseballs. The estate property, about 1,000 feet elevation in the Moon Mountain District, was on the way to a vineyard that my dad was developing for a man named Robert Kamen.
Who the screenwriter, producer, director.
You know, if you're in New York, look for Karate Kid musical coming soon. And, you know, Robert sold his first screenplay, bought this piece of property, wanted to, you know, had a wine thing going, but basically was convinced by my dad to develop this property into a vineyard.
So that's kind of a critical statement.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know Kamen. I mean, I know of him, and obviously he's brilliant and smart. I don't know if he's a slickster or not. But a lot of people are in Napa and parts of Sonoma as vanity projects.
Right.
How did he get to, like your dad? I mean, it's the greatest thing that he makes incredible wines and he's this slick guy, and then look who's, you know, doing his vineyard manager. It's awesome. But how did that...
I mean, the...
Your dad's a better salesperson than anybody thinks, then.
Well, this story has showed up in enough major publications that I don't feel bad saying it into a microphone on recording. He sold his first screenplay, came to Sonoma to visit with a friend. Friend takes him on a hike, and they get to the top of the mountain, and they eat a, you know, loaf of Sonoma French bread and some cheese and smoke a joint. And at the end of this experience, Robert says, well, I want to do two things. I want to buy this piece of property, and I want to find the guy who grew that pod, because I want to get some more of it. And, his friend says, was a real estate agent. He goes, well, good thing is the property is for sale, and we'll go find Phil Fattori. And that's, you know, that's what it came from. They had those, you know, those wine and weed similarities. You know, my dad had been developing mountain projects with some other people, and saw this raw land that Robert had bought and convinced him that he could put an organic vineyard there. Which
I'm not a ratings guy, but if you look at ratings, Cayman gets, you know, terrific ratings. Mm-hmm. So the idea of how it's farmed and, you know, Cayman being this sort of Hollywood guy or whatever, that they're making thoughtful wines is really
cool. It's you know, the opus. When Phil wants to convince somebody to hire him to do their vineyard, he takes them to the top of Cayman and says, you know, you can't have this, but we'll get you as close as we can.
Right. So the estate vineyard is only Zinfandel?
Only Zinfandel. Okay. Although, you know, Phil's never planted a straight Zinfandel vineyard in his life. No. So there's a little Sangiovese, there's some Merlot, there's some Alicante.
Isn't Phil straight oxymoronic?
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, okay. Everything's a little tie-dyed and crooked.
So let's leave it at that. All right. Then we mentioned it before, but another prominent vineyard is Dos Limones, which is very close and dear to the family and all of that. Just give me a little background on that and what you're growing there.
Yeah, so that is on the Sonoma Mountain side of the valley, about 500-600 feet elevation. It's, again, like I said, the first vineyard that my dad farmed organically starting in the late 70s. Was replanted at some point to Zinfandel, Sangiovese, and Syrah. So we get a little...
Go backwards a second. Yeah. First vineyard planted organically. What was the impetus or input that it went organic? Was it the owner? Was your dad ready to try something?
It was the owner. It was the owner. Okay. And we actually lease our tasting room and office space from the owner's grandchildren. And they've told us very importantly, it was the owner and his wife. It was the wife who said,
"Cool,
why don't you go and try do this? Let him do this. You know, it's going to be more expensive. There's going to be mistakes
made." And this
made,
is when? Is this 70s?
This is 79.
Yeah.
Everybody thought he was a crazy hippie.
I know.
You know, they were all right.
All right, and then there's an interesting vineyard, the Rossi, because a couple things I could note, and you'll expand on them. You're doing some blends from those, and there's an importance to your mom and dad to Rossi, right? So tell me a little about all of that.
So the Rossi Ranch is just above the little hamlet of Kenwood, north end of Sonoma Valley. It was originally planted in 1910 by Al Rossi's father, Carlo, no relation to the Jugwine.
Right.
Val, you know, was born that same year, sometime in the 30s, takes over running the property for his family and lived there until his death. In the 70s, Val hired my dad, he was 76, 77, to help, you know, with the vineyard management and run the harvest. And that was the year 77 that my mom had left the commune, first in Brooklyn, then in Cotati, living on the
She was in a commune in Brooklyn?
She was in a commune in
Brooklyn. Where's Cotati?
Cotati is it's in between Petaluma and Santa Rosa.
Okay, it's California. I never heard of it.
They pulled up stakes and moved to California and back to the land like everybody else. Right. And she needed a job. You know, in that time it was sort of like before... the migrant labor really started to show up.
Interesting.
And it was like, you know, broke hippies that would go out and pick grapes. So my parents met there picking grapes. Dad continued to farm there. I think, you know, Couturier Winery made some Rossi wines in the early days. And then after Val died, new family purchased it and brought us
stayed
back.
Stayed with it?
Stayed with it. Kept the name, saved the house, and brought my dad back in to farm it in 2012 or so. So we make three or four different wines from
there. It must be a pleasure to continue, you know, emotionally, you know, the actual food and everything.
I mean, there's pictures of me, you know, at 3 years old with my grandmother, you know.
When you were little? But then again, maybe you were never little.
I was always, you know, I've always been three, no matter what. Okay.
Right. We'll leave it at that. I know you grow and make wine from a vineyard in Oakville. We talked about Napa and how hot it is. Right. It's kind of unusual, and Oakville is like, you know, like Park Avenue.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, in a way.
This is funny. This is the you know, Park Avenue in the 80s. It was basically the first Enterprise Vineyards Napa Valley project. It was mostly a redeveloped vineyard. Again, Oakville Ranch.
Oakville Ranch is the winery.
Oakville
right?
Ranch is the winery. So they have a wine brand. It is truly like vaunted real estate. There's, you know, you drive past Dolavale to get there.
Yeah,
there's
a that place, whole area.
You know, there's a place where you can like stand and you look down and can spit in the general direction of Screaming Eagle.
Yeah, right.
It's like it is everything. Yeah. And in the replant, they pulled out this, you know, dead block of Chardonnay, and Enterprise Vineyards, Phil and Maya Commisolds convinced the ownership to let us plant a couple acres of Grenache. So to this day,
Cab and a couple acres of Grenache.
It's mostly Cab. There's some like a field blend Zinfandel, some Chardonnay, some superb Cabernet Franc, like some of the best Cabernet.
Really? Does anybody bottle just Cabernet Franc, or it's always a blending thing?
It goes into a lot of blends. I was able to secure a couple barrels of 2019 Oakville Ranch Cabernet Franc.
Yeah, sure.
It's you know, there's 48 cases. It's available to 16,600 members.
Did it come out great?
It justifies the price tag.
That's the fun stuff.
Yeah,
that's what it's all about. You know, doing it right, but all the passion projects and everything.
So, but the Grenache is the thing I love about the Grenache from Oakville. You know, you sit there and it's this neighborhood. It has the opulence that you'd expect from an Oakville wine, just in a Grenache form.
Right,
and it's basically the only Grenache bottled from the Oakville district. Everything else is, you know, Oakville Cabernet. Groth and Silver Oak.
Yeah,
and Opus
it's all that. It epitomizes what that area is. It's just funny that that's there. I'm surprised the Screaming Eagle guys don't yell and don't let that stuff blow this way.
You know what happens? We go to these Oakville tastings and we taste through all these Cabernets, and then I pour the Grenache last, and all the winemakers are like, "Wait, can I get some of that?"
So, clear up something for me. So, Oakville, they're giving you vines to make 16,600, plus is Enterprise managing everything else?
Yeah. I mean, we try and operate 16,600 as a separate entity from Enterprise Vineyards. It doesn't really
No,
work.
No, like, I know. Yeah, I yeah, didn't mean to yeah, confuse.
But, you know... It was just
wait. We, so it's sort to of, that point, it's sort does Enterprise modern. Manage Oakville's property?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And then 16,600 contracts
from Oakville.
Two, both.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
And obviously, because you know the source and all of that.
And the only grapes that we use for 16,600 have been grown by Enterprise Vineyards.
Right.
So it's all, you know, within that universe.
So. Your partners in these other vineyards, it's not what you demand of them. It's basically you're doing it.
Yeah.
It's not like Joe Schmeckelhead's owned this for 60 years and we tell Joe we want to farm organic. You go in there and, you know, do what you have to. There's a couple other things, Steel Plow, Muchas Piedras, right. What's going on there?
Steel Plow is actually on the valley floor, one of the few valley floor vineyards. Some Grenache and some Viognier there. Surrounds a winery called Landmark Winery in Kenwood. Cool site.
Very well.
Bottom of the, you know, the bottom of Sugarloaf Mountain. It's got this just crazy gravelly soil. Muchas Piedras is my personal vineyard baby.
A lot of stones?
Yeah, many rocks, a lot of stones.
I didn't say a lot of stone. Right, I said stones.
All the vineyards that we go to are a lot of stone.
Okay.
The Muchas Piedras is neighboring to the 16,600 estate.
Oh, cool.
And, the property got bought, and there was a sort of decrepit vineyard there, and we knew that the new owners wanted to make the vineyard productive, and, you know, struck a deal to plant this vineyard.
When did you go in and start turning everything around?
2014 was the day the year we planted Muchas Piedras. 16 was the first fruit off.
So it should be really coming into some stride now, right?
I think
feeling good.
I think they're going to be picking it sometime while I'm here in New York, and it's making me just a little crazy.
Well, it was your idea to come here.
Well, you know, you come when you can come. And so Muchas Piedras is mostly Grenache with one long terraced row of Mourvèdre and two dozen vines of Alicante Boucher.
Is that the right soil to grow Grenache necessarily or not necessarily?
One of the things that I love about Grenache so much, Sam, is... that it can grow in a lot of different places and ways.
And it does.
And it does.
There's a diversity of terroirs in the south and the north.
All over the planet, right?
Yeah, right. Spain.
But it can show a sense of place almost, you know, more accessibly than just about any other variety. So,
you
know,
and that's what you guys are about.
Right. Yeah. So you put it in a place with, you know, warm, just above the fog line, crazy rocks, and it's going to make this really sort of crunchy, acid-driven, but also ripe expression of Grenache.
I love that word, crunchy.
It's
starting to become overused, but it's the right word.
But when it
it's
is,
it's like this one is very mineral. What are you talking about? Crunchy, what are you talking about?
You want to feel it on your teeth, you know?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Support comes from the Pennsylvania Hemp Summit. Join us for the Pennsylvania Hemp Summit trade show and reception at the Farm Show Complex in Harrisburg on November 14th and 15th. Connect with industry stakeholders and grow the industry together through our 2023 industry planning sessions, industry and legislature panel discussions, success story sharing, professional development workshops, and a research showcase. Register to attend or get involved by exhibiting or sponsoring. Details at pahempsummit.com.
So, help me describe the winemaking. Is it a collaborative effort? I mean, are there a few people?
There's a few people.
It's not like, you know, Philip Matisse is making all the... tell me how that works.
It's collaborations with people that we grow grapes for, you know, for their main job, winery. Started with a guy named Jeff Baker, who founded Carmenet Winery, and then now is Stone Edge Farm. So we make some wine with Stone Edge Farm and Jeff Baker, and now his successor, Alejandro Zeman. We make some wine with Eric Bradley, who's, you know, a bunch of, came up from Richard Arrowwood's sort of cellar.
He's got good chops.
Yeah, he's got good chops.
A low-key guy, right?
Super low-key guy.
Right.
And then we work with Isabel Gassier from the Gassier family in France.
Oh, I know Gassier.
And she helps, you know, guide our Rhone production. And then we work with Will Buckland's nephew. They have a custom crush facility. And so Jack helps, you know, kind of guide some of our winemaking in their facility as well. So we, you know, keep it as complicated
as
possible.
It's interesting. But, you know, it's not the typical answer. It's kind of cool. Kind of fits into the vibe.
We're farmers. Do you, you know, we're not
winemakers. Right. Do you and your dad get in there?
Yeah.
I mean, you leave it to the experts, but don't you every now and then, like, something's right, really right, or not right?
You know, more often than not, you find that what you're supposed to do in the cellar is, again, it's pretty self-evident. It's you know, the grapes and the fermentation and the wine sort of guide you.
The low intervention term.
Low intervention.
You're bringing in the best fruit from, you know, smart farming.
Don't mess it up. Don't, you know, stay out of the way.
So based on that principle.
Right. So we're very involved in every piece of the winemaking, from, you know, calling the pick to, you know, how it's fermenting, and then obviously, you know, blending decisions and barrel decisions and stuff like that.
Right.
Know, on a regular
so very
basis.
Much involved.
Very much
right.
involved. Yeah.
Right. Is because of all the different things, you know, different winemakers, different vineyards, different varietals. I mean, I'm hoping the answer is no. I mean, there's not really a style, right? I mean, everything the vintage year, the vineyard, everything dictate, you respect that, right?
Yeah, I mean, if there was one style, it's, it's always going to change from vintage to vintage and vineyard to vineyard. But we trust the vines that we grow to reach a pinnacle of ripeness without sacrificing freshness and acidity. So, you know, there's a lot of people who pick the vineyards that we pick earlier than we do.
Sure.
Because they work with a lot of vineyards that they can't trust it to go that far without shutting
right.
down. And so we are not afraid of the fact that we're in California and in the sun and make wines that are, you know, my least favorite question is, what's your alcohol level? Because our alcohol levels are higher than average.
But what I know and what I respect and what I realize I like now is, you know, California has a profile. You know, it's warm and you can get terrific fruit there. But it's how you farm it and how you make it. You know, everything doesn't have to be balls to the wall, you know. Right. So, I mean, that's an important thing. And, I love that. Before we do the wine list and we taste wine, we talked about a lot of important things. Climate change, you know, proper farming and all that, proper winemaking. You know, wine is more than just the liquid in the glass. It's a community. Do you look at it that way? I would guess so based on the background, but people and how you treat them and how you compensate them and keeping them around. I mean, is that a common practice? Is it hard?
It's for sure it's hard. I think it's becoming more of a common practice. There's a whole lot less, people think of it as migrant farm workers and migrant labor, and that doesn't really exist anymore. We farm about 800 acres for Enterprise Vineyards, which is, not a huge number, but it's not a small number.
It's busy.
And there's essentially like 130 to 150 full-time employees.
Wow.
The base pay is, this point is now in the low 20s for somebody who's coming in and working in a vineyard picking up rocks.
The answer is yes. You have to.
The things that I'm honestly the most proud of, and I'm going to try to keep my eyes dry talking about it. These guys who worked for my dad, literally my whole life.
They're family.
They're family. This guy, I think of Miguel Santoyo, who was 18 on his paperwork for the first 2 years, came across the border got legal, became a citizen, owns a house, has put 3 kids through college.
And he's still with you guys?
He's still with us.
How
and
old is he?
He's
50, 60s?
He's probably in his mid-50s. He was 16.
He's a young guy.
He was 16 when I was born.
Right.
So he's 55, 56.
He's a young guy.
Yeah, he's a young guy.
That's a great story.
And that
was what the question was about.
Yeah, that's
why would he be there if you guys were dicks or whatever,
Don't ask the people that are working for you to go spray something on this crop that you wouldn't want in your own backyard. And if you start with that baseline, there's a sort of inherent respect for humanity.
100%.
That comes from it.
I agree. All right, last topic on the agenda, and I don't want to give you too much time on this, is you've been podcasting for a while.
Yeah.
Not like the last 20 minutes when it's been hot, but you've been doing it.
Yeah.
And it's a good podcast, and it does pretty well.
Yeah.
I have our company charts everything, right, and you see what everyone's doing. A lot of people do this and don't show up, on any of the charts. You guys do. So tell me about the podcast and tell me.
It's
a bunch of guys.
It grew out of the local public access radio station. But the concept was always, there's a grower perspective, which I bring. There's this guy named Bart Hansen who's worked in the
Tell stores. Everyone the name.
The Winemakers.
The Winemakers on Radio
on
Misfits.
Radio Misfits podcast network. You can get it on all the
wherever
places.
You get pods.
The same place that you got this podcast, you can
right.
find us. When you're done listening to Sam's show, listen to our show.
That's exactly it.
And so we have the grower perspective, the wine perspective, a sommelier, so the sort of sales side of it, and this old Chicago radio guy who represents sort of your average Joe consumer. And it started, we would just bring topics and it would be the four of us. And then, a few months in, that was 2017. And then a few months into it, we started bringing in folks to interview. And for the most part, people we interview are not the marquee names, but they're people who have side projects and, work as cellar masters and, small wineries, small farmers.
So you do something similar to what I do. When I started this, and you have a PR background, I have a sales and marketing background, It's like, who's the biggest guy I can get? Who's the most famous? You know, and that helps bring people in. But today, for me, it's morphed to the story. And the reason you and I are sitting here is obviously everyone who's been listening, there's a very cool story here. And it seems like that's what's important to you.
My favorite thing, you know, it's obviously it's been great for 16,600 and people listen and come to the tasting room because of that. But my favorite thing is when, you know, loyal 16,600 customers who listen to the podcast, and I see them like post on social media that they're drinking a bottle of wine that was, you know, one of our recent guests, and they went out and they found that bottle and are now, you know, are at a dinner table in North Carolina or Minneapolis or wherever, telling that story to whoever they're having dinner with. And that's just like...
There's more of that going on than you think, because people that choose to listen to your podcast or this have made a decision, and there's an intimate relationship, and they're listening. So the idea that, you know, they're going to try this wine after this or that stuff, it's always going to happen. So it's the Winemakers on Radio Misfits. It's been going on, what sounds like 5 years
already. We are closing in our 250th episode.
Me too.
Yeah.
So it should, you know. How frequent? Weekly, pretty much?
We try and be weekly.
Okay. I mean, I know that.
And,
that's...
you know, we don't do any editing.
Either
your,
do we.
Your 2 pages of notes that you wrote up are two more pages that I've ever written. It's pretty
trust me, there's no editing here. I'm not doing anything, and I didn't get to all of this stuff. All right, so that's the Winemakers on Radio Misfits. After listening to Sam, you can get the perspective that, you know, wine guy, wine family, wine maker, wine grower, and he surrounded himself with some other cool guys. So keep that in mind. All right, Sam, nobody leaves here without doing the wine list. The wine list is 5 questions. We've asked the same 5 questions to everyone for almost 250 podcasts. Nobody escapes it. Be brief. People love hearing what guys like you were drinking. I post everything on social media. You know, we have a whole data bank and all. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? And that is, what's in your fridge at home? What's interesting you? You're traveling in New York and D.C. Maybe you have exposure to stuff here that you... Right. Tell me some of the things you're drinking right now.
You know, at home, I drink a lot of more white wine than red wine.
Okay. What?
My favorite thing... It started during the, you know, the quarantine times. Really good friends of mine in Sonoma... the assistant or associate winemaker for Bedrock, but his personal label, Desire Lines Wines, and he makes fantastic Riesling from different vineyards.
I got to look for that.
And I think they get to New York a little bit.
So the Maker's Desire.
Desire
Who's
Lines.
The guy?
Cody Rasmussen.
Cody Rasmussen. Cody and Emily. And it's a Riesling from the grapes or from where?
The one that I really love is Cole Ranch.
Okay.
Up in you know, Anderson Valley area.
Well, give me a couple other things you're drinking. You know, that's a good one. That's why I asked you the question.
I love northern and southern Rhones. So there's, you know, a lot of San Josef.
Any water. Makers that rise to your top?
You know, I buy wine from this crazy guy in New York, and I know the people who are going to listen to this know him, Lyle Fass, and I don't
sure.
mind that I call him crazy guy.
Sure.
And so he, you know, gets all these wild small producers, and I'll buy some stuff from him.
So you're open to try stuff you haven't heard of?
You know, I...
You leave it to Lyle. He's out there pounding.
You know, and I have things that I love and that are my favorites, but I, you know, there's so much wine out there that I try and keep it fresh.
Alright, so give me, so I could post...
Yeah.
Give me one wine and maker that came through a Lyle that you like. Can you remember?
I can't remember any names off the top of my brain. But you know what I'll do is I'll give a shout out to Domaine Gossier. They're in Nîmes, and I, you know, anytime I
stuff.
Can find their wine, I'll buy a bottle.
I agree with
helps
you
us
that.
A lot, and their, you know, their family, good farming. Good winemaking, Cote d'Aron, the whole deal.
All right, I'm gonna post that stuff. Right. Second question, maybe the goofiest, but I'm pretty sure you'd be happy with this question. Okay. Favorite wine and food pairing, not what you. Good setup, right? Not what you think is good, what you like. And I know it's not something you eat every night, week, month, but when you do it, it's the old ooh-ah, man. This is And you, there's a grape nation rule. You can't say champagne and oysters.
All right, that's fair. I believe in...
I love a guy who closes his eyes to answer a question like that. Go ahead.
I very much want to, like, not deep platform, but, you know, kind of, like, bring it down a little bit with the wine and food pairings. And with that, I started an event that we do at the tasting room called Tacos du Rhone. And
love that.
You know, I love, like, an al pastor taco
with
and a glass of Grenache.
Okay.
You know,
so al pastor, which has got some body.
Yeah, it's got some body. The Grenache, it's got the sweetness. It's got the, you know, it's not like super, it's salty, but it's not over the top. You don't want it totally spicy because you want to catch some of those other flavors.
I think that's a great answer. I could tell you two things. Nobody's ever given me that answer before. And the other one is, for some reason, I think you're expert on that answer. Okay, we'll move along on that. All right. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And I think, I know you travel, and I know COVID kind of hit everyone. Give me stuff up around you. So when people hit that area, you know, coming from you, who, like, where's a place, the list is cool, the people are great, the vibe is right, they're knowledgeable?
Yeah, there's two places that come to mind immediately. One in Napa, one in Sonoma. In Napa, it's a place called Torque, T-O-R-C.
It's a restaurant, too, right?
Restaurant,
yeah, restaurant and great wine list.
Great wine list, great food, great cocktail program. You know, they're in the heart of Napa. They have all those sort of Napa things that you expect. But there's also some, you know, fun stuff to dig into a little bit from all over the world.
That's a good one.
And then lately, it's these friends of mine who opened the spot on the plaza called Valley Bar and Bottle.
I've heard about it. Yeah, I heard it's terrific.
It's terrific.
Who are the people behind it?
So it's... Lauren Feldman, Tanner Wally, Emma Lipp, and Steph Rieger. And they all have some New York connections. Tanner worked for, what's the guy with the beard? Terroir.
Select. Paul Greco.
Yeah, Paul Greco. I think that Lauren and Emma were all at...
in New York?
Not the Spotted Pig, the... You know, they're
the
all
Breslin
like,
or something.
They had some like New York restaurant connections.
So it's got a good hybrid.
It's got that sort of you know, a New York sensibility.
Is
but
there
also,
food there?
The food is fantastic.
It is.
Food is fantastic.
So it's just a good all around
bottle
place.
Shop. Great wine list. You know, it goes some natural, but a lot of like, you know, the first question that they ask a supplier is, you know, what's the farming like?
Right. That's important to them.
That matters so much.
All right, those are good ones. Like I said, I'll post them. All right, fourth question, favorite all-time wine. When I initially structured this question, I brought people in where I wanted to know what their most expensive and rare wine they ever tasted. I can give a crap about that. I've said this 200 times. I want to know about the wine that was either a gateway, life-changing, changed the way you thought about it, still important to you. Could be one, could be two.
Yeah.
Do you have a wine like that you could cite?
There's two that come to mind immediately. And, you know, for me, it's wines that, like, when you get down to the last sip in your glass, you don't want to drink it because you want to have something there to keep smelling. And the first one that was like really hit home for me was 1997 Sangiovese that my uncle made from Cayman's property.
Really?
And it was just...
97 was a good year in California.
97 was a great,
California.
Great year in California. Transcendent bottle of wine. You know,
and were the grapes, they weren't that young or anything?
They were... And that was, you know, that vineyard had probably been planted 4 or 5 years earlier.
Okay.
Young vines... you know, it was when we were all chasing Sangiovese as sort of like the next Cabernet in Sonoma, and it never really took off. Since been cut over to Grenache, actually. But that's one that, like, I was like, oh yeah, there's something here. The other one that I think of all the time when I think of like my favorite wine moment, 2010 Araujo Syrah.
So 10 was another great vineyard. Yeah. Araujo was a great maker, a luxury maker.
Totally.
But Syrah was not their big wheelhouse.
Think of.
So he probably spent a lot of time, you know, in the vines. And I don't think I've had it.
I've since found a couple and stuck them in my cellar. Hopefully,
get I'm sure back you can find them back. For $400 or $500 a bottle.
Yeah, you know, it was no it problem. wasn't quite that bad. But right, now
last question, and then we're gonna taste the wine, and then I got to get you out of here. So you should be able to do this, and it could be your wines or anyone else's, any region. I'm looking for you to recommend the best wine around $15-$20. $20-$22. I'm looking for a red Recco. I'm looking for a white Recco. My kids are in their mid-late 20s, 30s. They can't afford $50, $60 bottle of wines. They're not bringing $11 crap supermarket wine that we talked about. What's that wine that was? And you could go category. Like, yeah. I think Muscadet for the money
totally
is killer. Well, what? Give me a kind of Recco or two.
White wine at that price point, I'd probably be finding like a bottle of Vino Verde.
Okay.
Something from Portugal.
Okay, I think that's a great Recco. I think the values are there, and they're making good
totally.
Money.
For red wine, you know, the self plug, and you know, I know Jake's in the other room listening to this. This is good for field blend also. We make a Sonoma Valley Zinfandel. It's one of the few non vineyard
in that 22 buck range.
You know,
I was hoping maybe you had a wine.
In the low 20s, $25 a bottle.
That's great.
You know, if it's
wait,
not,
so give me the exact. So it's the 16600 Zinfandel.
Sonoma Valley Zinfandel.
Sonoma Valley. Yeah, and it's labeled Sonoma.
It's labeled Sonoma
and
Valley.
And there are other Zinfandels that with have
the
estate, designates.
The other vineyard designates. This is.
Okay.
You know, kind
so
of
like
a
I said, catch-all. We'll post that. All right, good job on that. Like I said, I'll post that. It'll be in our social media. All right, so every week we taste a different wine on air. When I have a winemaker, why wouldn't I sit here and taste his wines? That's why I asked you and Jake to bring a wine. So we are tasting the 16600 2018 Dos Limón Syrah, very important emotional vineyard to the family, on Sonoma Mountain. All right, so tell me a little about this wine. Let's talk about, we talked about the vineyard, talk to me about the vintage, talk to me about anything else.
Yeah, 2018, great year. Largest crop in the history of the state of California. No climactic calamity at all.
Drama.
You know, no drama, no heat spikes, no rain, no fire. So it was just a great year. Late year, we picked things late in 2018. It took a long time to get right.
Even with all the climate change BS,
it was just, you know,
it's funny, yeah.
What I love about this wine is a few things. Starting in the 2015 vintage, and this came to me as an idea from another winemaker. We make a little Viognier, comes from the Steel Plow Vineyard. When we press the Viognier, we fill up painter's buckets, you know, 5 gallon painter's buckets, usually 8 to 10 of them, with the skins from the Viognier. I take them to a big giant walk-in freezer and put them in there and wait for the Syrah to come in. You know, usually 2-3 weeks later, we'll go pick the Syrah. I'll go take those skins out of the freezer and add them to the must right at the beginning of
really?
The and so that's it's a little nod to Côte Roti, but in California, we don't need the sugar from the Viognier to help. We just need aromatics and textural
Viognier
elements.
Viognier is great aromatics.
And sort of, you know, for me, just kind of like finishes the wine. This is, you know, Syrah can be a little rough around the edges sometimes, kind of polishes some of those edges. This wine ages super, super well.
Well, it's already got, you know, 4 years of bottle age, which is takes a little of the edges off. All right, so we do a little evaluation. So let's talk color.
Yeah.
Pretty deep, dark edges,
for
right?
Sure.
You know,
and
good Syrah.
Yeah, and the, counterintuitively, adding the white grapes to this actually helps set that color a little better.
Yeah, too. Which is crazy. All right, get it up into the schnoz and get. I suck at nose descriptors. Tell me what you get on the nose on this particular wine. There's a lot going on there.
There's a lot going on. You know, it's not bacon. But it's just like the bacon fat.
Which is classic Rhone,
classic Syrah.
It's not overwhelming.
It's not, but it's not.
I get in a good way a little vegetal.
Yeah, there's a little like.
Right away I got that. And I love that, unless it's done wrong.
You know, it's not. Again, it's 2018, so, you know, maybe it could have gotten riper, but we just had to pull it. But I don't think it's not green vegetal.
No,
floral herbal vegetal.
Yeah, there's a nice touch to that.
You know,
it's hard not to notice, but it's not negative. All right, let's go mouthfeel. It's mouth filling, and then I want you to tell me. It's mouth filling. It's not unctuous,
right,
or glycerin-y, but it's, I'd say medium plus.
Medium plus.
But not overbearing.
You know, I want to feel a wine from the front of the palate to the back of the palate. I don't like when there's
so holes. Let's go palate.
Yeah.
So before we talk about how it feels, does the palate mirror what you get on the nose? You know, a little of that bacon fat. You get anything else? Give me some descriptors on the palate.
It's pretty dark.
I was going to say dark fruit.
Dark fruit. Like past blue to black fruit. You know, a little blackberry kind of experience. There's definitely a good, you know, it's not peppery, but it's sort of like
spicy.
A little spice to it. Yeah, it's not like peppery. Sort of essence of it.
We would have said pepper early on, but there's a spice in there.
Hit you over the head with those pepper kind of notes, but there's just enough sort of like something to kind of make you sit up and take a little notice.
So I think on the palate, it's very, you get that initial attack. The mid palate is there, and then I think when you pull the glass away, it opens up nicely in the mouth.
And it opens. This is the thing that, you know.
I mean, I'm still
right, and it opens. It opens up as opposed to down. And I think that like at the back of the palate to sort of lift up and expand as opposed to fall down is so important to us.
What's a great wine pairing for this? There's two things. There's what goes with Syrah. There's what goes with this wine. What goes with this vintage, and what you think.
You know, can I just kind of like lean in on? You know, everybody wants to talk Lamb and Syrah, but I think with this wine not being as sort of like over the top as some Syrahs can be, you want to keep it a little lighter than that. You know, maybe like. Some duck breast or something like that.
I think it would go great with duck, but I think it would be awesome with a juicy burger dripping down. Fatty skirt steak, which is very in your face, which other wines can handle. This would be great with it. Yeah. I think in that zone, there's a good, you know, with and all of that. All right, so that's the 2018 Dos Limones Syrah from Winery 16600. Sam, we got to wrap up. I told you this would go quickly. We've been doing it an hour and 10. I want to thank our guest, Sam Kotori. Sam Kotori is the proprietor at 16600, Winery 16600, out in Moon Mountain in Sonoma. Best place to get info online?
Yeah, check. We actually just launched a brand new website, winery16600.com.
So W-I-N-E-R-Y.
Yeah, winery.
S-I-X.
16, the word, 600.
600.
Yeah.
And
social media is great.
If we want to follow you on social media, you, the winery, the podcast, give me some handles.
16600 is the winery on Instagram and Twitter. Grapes with a View is my personal Instagram.
So Sam's personal is Grapes with a View.
And that one I'm probably more active on than the other one. And then Winemakers Pod.
It's under Winemakers.
Is the both on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay. So and I'll post that stuff too. And lastly, because...
And wherever, if you're in New York, wherever Field Blend is selling the wine is a good place to find information about it.
Right. And for somebody who's been to over 100 Dead concerts.
Okay.
Let's talk about the label. Who designed the label?
We forgot about that whole part. So our label is designed by an artist named Stanley Mouse.
Say no more to people who know.
If you know, you know. And if you don't know, you actually do know. Because
he's a cultural artist of his time.
The things that, you know, if you close your eyes and picture a poster from San Francisco in the 60s, what you see Stanley Mouse made. You know, Skull and Roses, every Journey album.
That cover. Skull and Roses gatefold album is
Exactly.
Yeah. And then it became a great t-shirt and all
the whole deal. So
Fillmore West posters, all kinds of crap.
Everything. You know, Steve Miller Band with the flying, you know, the Pegasus, the whole thing. And, you know, I grew up with his kids in Sonoma. And when we needed a label, he said, Stanley, what do you got? And we expected we'd get something wild and psychedelic. And he he had just done this oil portrait of a pencil.
I know,
woman
that's kind of controversial. For Stanley Mouse.
So, his first of all, range of just in styles that he can do. But a lot of his contemporary work is these oil-based portraits.
Yeah.
So it's cool.
He's alive?
He's alive.
How old is he about? 60s? Maybe 70s?
He's going to be 82 or 83 this year.
So he was an adult when he was hanging with them. He was maybe older than them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Very cool.
And, still going. He has a studio out in Sebastopol.
Is he out?
Great follow on
Twitter. I
got
to get out
Facebook.
There and check that out. Maybe you'll have to hook me up with him.
If you come out, we'll go out and see Stanley.
All right, so I want to thank again Sam Kotori. Thank you to all our engineers at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.